And welcome back to Historians of the Movies podcast. This is your host and creator, Demigod. I think now, since I watched Dune 2 last night, something along those lines. I think Prophet probably sounds nice. I don't know. I've got three followers here, I'm sure, that are coming along in the cult of Jason. They are Colin Colbert, Luke Truxell, and Sarah Myers, who is giving me the famous Sarah Myers look of "you're being stupid again." So thank you for that, all of you guys. Colin's like, "I'm in. Let's go." Is there snacks?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really just along for the ride, man. Let's do it. Let's go ahead.
Like, I feel like we could do a cult. I feel like this could be good. I can barbecue. Like, I don't know, Luke. What do you think? What
no,
do
you look Luke for in a cult? No human sacrifice. That's the rule.
Yeah,
I mean, we got to think about what is our cult going to be all about. Is it going to be about movies? Is it going to be about the air war? Is it going to be just a cult about how much we love John Egan, you know, and Callum Turner as John Egan? Because I can get down with that cult.
That's right. Callum Turner may be the right answer.
Let's talk about Callum Turner for a second before we jump into this pod. We're now on to episode 7. We only have 2 more episodes to go of this series before we have to go off and find something else. Guys, there's a whole lot of episodes of Battlestar Galactica. I'm just going to put that out there. Sarah's like, not again. No more of this. I wasn't real familiar with Callum Turner's work. I knew he was just in the new film Boys in the Boat. I find that he has been unquestionably the most charismatic actor to follow on this show. Maybe he's just got the guy having the most fun. Maybe he gets the best lines, whatever. I feel like of our three main leads now, four main leads, because if we count Crosby, right? Egan, man, he's the fun guy you want to follow. Am I wrong?
I mean, he is that way in real life. He was very popular with the group. But I will say what's probably shaping our opinion of that is with the writing, you have kind of three straight-laced, kind of straight guys. And then you have the very big, loud, boisterous Egan. And, you know, when you think about Crosby, you know, very quiet, very serious, very straight. You have Rosie, quiet, straight, with a little humor, but still mostly kind of quiet. And then you have Buck Clevin, who's usually playing opposite of Callum Turner. So you have kind of three guys that are very serious. And then you have Egan, who's, you know, when he's funny, he's funny. When he's serious, he's serious. But he's just kind of that element of just kind of just captures the screen and is larger than life. And he was that way in real life. So, again, I think that, you know, is intentional, but also is kind of also true historically as well.
He's got the swag.
I want a bomber jacket so bad, but I would feel like a fraud to have a bomber jacket and not be on a bomber crew. These are things I think about way too much. Oh, really?
Yeah.
You can get one?
I went on the website. The Eastman, right? I think, Luke, is what it is. Eastman makes the jackets for that. And you can get one for like a cool $2,000.
Yeah. Egan, the jacket that he wore, Clevin hated it, but basically it was the old Army Air Corps jacket that they were using. And they were discontinuing it for a kind of a new line. I'm not an expert on like the jackets and stuff, but this is what I read, is that the story goes is that Egan paid a little extra money to get it in San Angelo, Texas, when they were out there, and because he thought it was cool and he liked it. And so there's a lot of stuff Egan does kind of prior to and during World War II that he, you know, it interests him. You know, if you think about the Fez, there's a lot of pictures, historical pictures of him with the Fez. I think it's a Fez, right?
Yeah, it's it's at the museum. You can go see it at the 8th Air Force Museum.
So, yeah, there's a lot of pictures of him with it on in briefings. Like, he didn't just wear it. Like, they only show one scene of it in Master of the Air when he's in North Africa. He wore that to briefings back in England. And there's a picture of him at a briefing with it.
That's
so,
good.
So, again, you know, Callum Turner's doing a great job of portraying him, and they're doing a great job of writing that role. So, again, some of it is designed that way with three very serious guys and one kind of – just big personality, but that was also kind of true as well. And I think they're doing a great job of showing that.
He's a little bit, he's kind of the id. He's kind of the swagger. He's the single guy too, which in this episode really, plays a role. And I don't know, his acting, I think has been incredible. I think he's kind of rises to that sort of Dick Winters kind of level for me. Damian Lewis. Thank you. In Band of Brothers, where it's like an iconic character. And I think that comes down to acting it as well.
Can I talk a little bit about our fourth guest today? who is just here. People may have just heard right now. Sarah, do you want to talk about our fourth guest?
My cat is, I don't know how to describe my cat, but she is loving and needs to sit on my shoulder, but she will not sit on my lap. She only wants to be petted. She's a typical cat, right? She only wants to be petted when she's in the mood for it. And she's right now demanding attention. So she was rolling all over my shoulder until she decided that she'd had enough. And then she bit me and ran away. So this is where we are. This is my cat. Some people call their cats an asshole. And I've always been like, oh, well, these people must just not like cats. And then I met her and I was like, oh, okay. I know what we're talking about now. Like, she's an asshole. Doesn't mean I don't love her and treat her very well, but yeah.
Can you share her name? I know her name.
She does not have a tail. So her name, the adoption shelter named her Taylor, T-A-I-L-O-R. And as my friend Jason likes to say, I remind her of her disability every day because of her name. she was born without a tail, and she and her sisters were adopted, and she was the only one left. And I thought she looked really cute because she was this tiny little kitten without a tail. And then she got bigger and she became an asshole. So that's the story of my cat.
Yeah. She picked a hell of an episode, I think, to make an appearance here on this pod.
Sure.
Did we just jump right in to our first cat appearance on Masters of the Air? Because I thought, opening up. Okay, let's just set the stage. Let's just jump in. For those of you listening now, we've had a tremendous discussion this last week, mostly called Luke is upset about something. On this episode, we're going to jump into that. We've had a time jump in this episode. We're now into March 1944. Some of our heroes are now at Stalag Luft 3. I don't know how to say three in German. How do you, Drei. Ike's getting close. Now I'm thinking about Inglourious Basterds with the scene with Michael Fassbender and so forth. Either way. A cat.
That's a great one.
Yeah. And we see a cat. And I'm like, oh, sweet. They're going to have a pet. And he says, oh, do you have any water? And it's like, oh, they're going to have some water for the pet. It's...
Oh, Jason.
and now Taylor's back on screen. Does that happen? Were there pets in POW camps? This cat was kind of feral until it was dinner. So.
Because you have to think about the level of desperation, right? So, Luke and I'm answering.
I would say I would doubt that because they're not getting a lot of food. And so any animals that were there were fair game. And I would imagine animals would learn to stay away after a while. I don't think there were any pets to my knowledge, because, again, any kind of food you can get, you know, you're getting very little from the Germans. I was asked about in the chat, y'all asked me to take a look at some of the Red Cross stuff. They're getting Red Cross parcels with food about once a month. And some of the stuff the Germans are giving them have like bugs and stuff coming out of it. And it's like some of the grain has like worms in it. So any animal that looks like you can kill it and eat it might be an upgrade from what you're getting from either the Red Cross parcels or the food that the Germans are giving you.
Can I interject real fast? I know like Colin's teeing up here, but I do want to like go back to last week's HATM film that we talked about, which implies that yes, if it bleeds, you can kill it, Luke. And of course that is Predator, the greatest history movie of all time. Colin, they make the reference in this episode. It's like, hey, this is a Luftwaffe camp. Things weren't that bad, but it's not like they were good. Correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's not like they were good. I mean, I would say, It's such an interesting thing because I've spent so much time working on Americans in Japanese POW camps or Americans who have been captured by the Japanese, with the exception of maybe if you were in a Soviet in a German camp in the East, it was universally worse to be an American in a POW camp in the Pacific. And, you know, of course, they reference here the Red Cross. They reference the fact that there's mail coming in, which is a fantastic thing. And of course they have food coming in, but in a very similar way that the Japanese did as well. Of course, when you get giant food packages in, what's the first thing you're going to do if you're a German and maybe you're a little hungry too? You're going to grab all the best stuff out of there and you're going to, you know, basically pillage that and just sort of leave what's left over for the guys that you don't really care too much about. But the International Red Cross did a lot of work and actually, you know, maintained. They actually also, you notice one of the things I noticed when, as soon as we sort of opened in the camp, there was all the, and my wife, Rachel, even commented, she was like, wow, they all have such nice coats. They all have like, everyone looks so cozy. Lots of, they have these like cool wool, like hats and stuff like that. And I was reading up and the Red Cross actually got, I don't know if this specific camp got these, but at some point the Red Cross had sent like 5,000 coats from like the First World French in the First World War, something like that, like these big wool coats that had just been sort of in storage. And so that's kind of how they got these sort of non-American issue warm coats out there, which I thought was really cool. A really cool thing to see and to think about. And of course, you know, it was kind of crazy how both March, the winter of 43-44 and 44-45 were some of the worst in sort of that area in general as well, in terms of it being freezing cold. And so one more thing I want to talk about the Red Cross. What was so valuable, of course, the food, the warmth, you know, keeping these guys with mail. I mean, the morale boost from mail is huge. The Red Cross also did a great job of communicating back to the U.S. So a lot of the times the families would find out that these guys were not missing in action, not killed in action anymore, because the Red Cross would have a, you know, the record keeping in Germany meant that the Red Cross could send a card back and say, hey, this is where your loved one is. They're in this camp. You can send them mail here. And the Red Cross was not present. The Japanese did not allow the Red Cross in the Pacific. And so in the Pacific, these same guys, thousands, hundreds of thousands of POWs, going back to, of course, the Philippines campaign, nobody knew anything about these guys until the war was all the way over and the Japanese finally let the Red Cross in. So I just think that that's such an interesting contrast. And I thought that was interesting about sort of a group that I think we kind of take the Red Cross kind of for granted a little bit. It's just something you kind of hear a lot. And they're often involved in sort of human rights investigations and things like that in Europe. And of course, aid right now, it's a big deal. But I think that's something that's super interesting from World War II as well.
Yeah, and I just wanted to shout out, whenever Colin was saying that there the Americans in these Japanese POW camps, there were women in the Army Nurse Corps and Navy Nurse Corps who were also taken as POWs alongside the men that they had been medically like providing for, who were in these camps for basically the duration of the war, right? Because the Philippines, you know, fall so quickly. And so those women who were on Bataan and Corregidor, they're like also in these camps, and they, when you're asking about pets, like they don't talk, they talk about eating any animal that they could get access to. Because, and like Colin said, like, especially for the Japanese, the reason why it's worse in the Pacific for people in POW camps is because the Japanese get to the point where they can't even feed their own people, like in Japan, right? People are starving. And so if your own people are starving and your troops are like very underfed and not getting any sort of nutrition at all, then you're certainly not going to provide for people in POW camps. So the nurses talk about, like, towards the end, they're eating grass mixed with like cold cream and like all kinds of crazy things to survive. So it gets really dire for, you know, in the Pacific theater for POW camps, basically.
Yeah, the bugs are just extra protein. I mean, and yeah, you know, everything you're eating is filled with maggots, and that is in some ways a bonus. And, you know, in the Pacific, and yeah, not just in Japan, of course, guys who are held in these tiny islands that are being surrounded and starved out by the Americans, let's say never invaded. And so these guys are just in these prisons, and they're withering away. And yeah, they're definitely not getting fed.
Sarah, before we jump back into this European campaign, do we notice a difference? Do the Japanese treat women any differently than the male POWs? Is there a difference in that at all?
No, which is interesting to me because there's always the argument. So historically in the U.S., even though women have been fighting in combat since the American Revolution, people have made arguments about like women's roles. When you think about the wars where we start to have, you know, after the Civil War, where you start to have like regulation of troops, where you have to see a doctor beforehand, you can just show up and go, things like that. Then you don't have women serving in combat for the U.S. And so the age old argument about this is like, oh, well, what if they're captured as POWs? Like, what will the enemy do to them? The women who are nurses in Bataan, they said they're not like sexually assaulted. Like there was one story of a nurse who said that a Japanese soldier like tried some sexual, but then like didn't go through with it. And so she said that the nurses said that they thought maybe that's because they were wearing like the pant version of their uniform and that the Japanese might have had some like cultural like assumption about them, but they're in the same camp. They medically, cause they've, you know, taken a Hippocratic oath. So they see themselves as providing still as medical providers, even when they don't have anything to provide with. And so they're still helping men with what limited resources they have while they're in the camps with them.
And we talked a little bit about this last week, but I still want to continue to explore this because I think that this is a really noteworthy thing to talk about, especially because we don't see what happens in American POW camps for German prisoners of war or Japanese prisoners of war, at least in film. So can any of the three of you kind of illustrate maybe where some differences are? Is there just a general agreement going on between the parties at war who were saying, okay, we will agree that you can send mail back and forth? How does this get worked out? Like, is there a gentleman's agreement during conflict? What's going on here?
I don't know all the like back details. I can speak generally to it, but do either one of you know like details of how this works itself out?
Unfortunately, I don't know any details, but they are getting information back and forth. And sometimes one of the reasons why with regards to the Western allies, let me emphasize the Western allies. Sometimes the reason why they show more restraint, the Germans show more restraint, is they are afraid of reprisals against their own prisoners. So there are gentlemen's agreements in this war, but it's not like, you know, they shook hands sometimes or officially. It's, you know, like that's how targeting, you know, area bombing and bombing cities between the British and the Germans really becomes a thing. Now, it had already been going on with the, you know, with Rotterdam, with Warsaw, but the Germans did initially try to avoid bombing cities. And then basically two German pilots accidentally bombed London. And, you know, this is kind of told in the film, you know, Battle of Britain, but it's in a lot of air war histories as well, is two German pilots accidentally bombed like a London suburb. And then the British retaliated by bombing, I think, some German cities. I think it may have been Berlin. And then basically the Germans then retaliated with the Blitz. And that's where we start to see kind of that area bombing campaign and that ramp up throughout the rest of the war. But the same is to be said about prisoners, all kinds of other things, poison gas. The reason why Germans aren't using poison gas against the Western allies, and a major reason is they're afraid it's going to get used against them and vice versa. There's a lot of things that we see where maybe there is some restraint on the Germans, where it's not because they're like, it's against their ideology to do something like that. They're more thinking about what might be the blowback if they do it, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And there are iterations of the Geneva Conventions that have existed from the 19th through the 20th century. So you see different iterations of that. Doesn't mean that people are following it. Cause like Colin said, for people in the Pacific, if you're in a POW camp, then it's like radio silence. Like you don't know. Right. Like, and so, yeah, you're going to say something, I think, Colin.
I was going to say that German POWs who were held here in the United States had it very, they were very well treated. Maybe better than, you know, the Japanese internees, not just the Japanese POWs, but the Japanese internees in the West Coast. But the Germans, we had POW camps all over the country, and, you know, lots of notable mentions of them, especially in I remember hearing about ones in Iowa and in those places where the Germans liked it so much that a lot of them stayed and like made homes and you know, became American after the war. There was a, they also practiced their own sort of subtle version of sort of, of what's the defiance. There's a POW camp out near Camp Shelby in Mississippi, out where I, near where I went to school at Southern Miss. And, they, you know, sort of dug a swastika in the ground, you know, beneath the barracks or something. I can't remember. It was something like that. And so they were still out there, you know, many of them still indoctrinated and stuff like that, but they were treated very well. You know, of course, we were hoping that when, you know, for the same reasons we've all talked about here, we're hoping if the better we treat them, the better our guys will be treated. Now, the difference is while we have things like rationing and stuff here in the United States, the bellies are full for the most part. In Germany, as especially as the war went on, most of the people, most of the guys who were in those camps in the late, like late 1944, you know, before the U.S. had actually pushed all the way through and liberated some of those camps, they knew nothing of the Red Cross packages and of mail and those kind of things. It just deteriorated as the German situation deteriorated. And it was the same for the Japanese.
Yeah, one of the things I found interesting here, you know, these guys are all living very close companionship with their German captors. We see the size of these camps. We see that, you know, they're not just huts. There's cafeterias. There's all this kind of stuff. And you also see that these guys have very real relationships with their captors. These guys get to know each other on a pretty real basis. Do they? I kind of wonder. And I hate to say that everything's are happy and glory and happy and all that during warfare, but I kind of wonder, do we see in the archive, I wonder if there are friendships mentioned where like, it's like, yeah, I got to know this guard. He was okay. You know, kind of a thing, you know, we see those kind of relationships here in the episode. Do we not?
I haven't ever read, I'm thinking about what I've seen in the archives. I've never read of anybody saying that they still, like, you know, after the war, kept in touch with anybody from the camps or anything like that. But I haven't read extensively on it. So that's just my limited knowledge, is I haven't ever seen that taking place. You guys?
I think that you definitely, I mean, Luke, if you have, I'll say this real quick, and then Luke, if you have specific, you know, knowledge of that stuff. What I know is that you're always identifying the guys who are the most lenient. And, you know, maybe, it's hard to say if you would ever become friends with these guys. Mm-hmm. Maybe they did, but I know that you're constantly trying to game the system. So you're always looking for the one that will let you have a little bit more, that will give you a little bit more freedom, that will look the other way in some situations. And, you know, I'm not sure if a true friendship, unless it's someone who's really like actually trying to like help you the entire time, maybe. I don't know, Luke, have you ever seen anything like that?
I've seen kind of the opposite, where they could be quite derogatory towards the guards. You know, the word that kept coming up a lot that I've seen is goons. Yeah, there's some guys they respected more than others, but for the most part, they hated them. Okay. They probably may have hid it, you know, and found ways to disguise it, but right. Internally, they hate these guys. And they, you know, it kind of comes up in the episode, but internally and amongst a lot of the officers, they've come up with this idea that they're going to make their lives hell in any way. Any way you can cause kind of just any kind of annoyance, break equipment, mess things up. I saw one thing where they shut down someone found a way to shut down the entire electrical grid, you know, or like, I don't know if electrical grid, but like something with the power caused a power outage and caused some problems. And yeah, that affected other prisoners, but it also affected the guards and caused some issues. And the idea is they found ways to be, just to make their lives hell, just to resist in some kind of form or fashion. And that's part of what the tunnel digging is all about. A lot of times the Germans know about the tunnels before they even like catch them. They just let them dig a little bit longer, and because it keeps the prisoners busy when they know about a tunnel and they're tracking it. And then when they reach a certain point, the Germans basically come in, bust the tunnel up, fill it in. And, you know, so there is a game going on here, not a good game, you know, but there is some, but this is, the Americans have come up with, and the British as well, they're going to try to do everything they can to fight the war from these prison camps. And if that means making the lives of these guards hell, they're going to do it. And so a lot of the accounts that I see and read about is they don't like these guys. They some officers they may have more respect for than others, but the attitude is we're going to make their lives hell, and we're going to find ways to do that. So there's a level of resistance there that sometimes is passive and sometimes is more outright. And in fact, the guards do break the Geneva Convention on it a couple times. And there's a bigger thing that we could talk about that would be more of a spoiler. But there's a non-spoiler thing where, you know, I've seen accounts of guards just randomly shooting into the prison, you know, beds, you know, or, you know, just like shooting into the hut effectively. And they wounded one guy and crippled one officer that way. Another account of them just randomly, a guard randomly shooting an American officer. So it doesn't happen often because the Americans are getting intelligence back on what's going on through their own ways and means. And the Germans are trying to keep, are worried about their own POWs. So they do try to keep it down. But there's animosity between the guards and the Americans. It's not like a Hogan's Heroes. It's they don't like each other.
Yeah. We're still at war. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you are, you know, what I was saying earlier is that you are trying to find the ones that you can manipulate the most, right? Like, it's not like you're saying, oh, I like this guy better. It's more like I can get more out of this person. You know, I can go further in sort of my resistance or to make my life better, you know, with the guy that looks the other way when you're trading food back and forth, you know, these market economies that come up inside these camps and sort of how that all works. But yeah, it's definitely not a good situation.
I want to pivot away from the camp for a moment, and let's go. Luke, we've been watching this show now for, you know, several weeks. We've got a new term here, Black Monday. We're no longer out of what's going on here. We've got a situation here. Rosie's sitting at 24. His crew's sitting at 24 sorties now. We've got this thing called Black Monday. The guys are coming back. We're used to seeing this on the show by now. They're counting the forts as they come in. And I'm like, oh, these guys are doing good. And then we found out, no, this was actually very, very bad. Luke, what's going on with Black Monday?
Well, Black Monday is a part of kind of this, the Battle of Berlin. Basically, there's two battles of Berlin. You can get confused by them. There's the ground one, which is kind of where the war ends. But then there's the air one, which is actually going on for months. It starts out as an RAF campaign. And then basically, the Americans are convinced to come along. Ultimately, the failure of the air battle above Berlin, really hurts Arthur Harris, who commands Bomber Command, politically, and his ability to kind of dictate the future of the air war because of how many British and American airmen are lost during the course of this campaign that goes on for months. You know, and this starts kind of around October, November, and continues really up through really up to April. But what has happened is, you know, we have a time jump, so we have to talk about a lot of changes. You know, something my book talks about is there's a lot of command changes, but one of the big command changes is Karl Spatz is now running the air war overall effectively for the Americans. And he wants to gain air superiority, you know, and this is one of the problems I had is they didn't do a good job of laying out, you know, what the overall strategy is. And they kind of like did a throwaway line at the end that now we're going to talk about it going into the next episode. But basically Spatz comes in and one British commander, they're having this huge debate about what to do for Overlord. One British commander by the name of Leigh Mallory, who's coming up with the pre-bombardment plan for Overlord, says, we're just going to win air superiority over the beaches and fight the Germans in the air when we land. And Spatz said, that's absolutely unacceptable. We're going to win the air war. We're going to defeat the Luftwaffe before then. And so what he does is he marshals his resources, his fighter pilots, and in fact, he takes an entire tactical air force, takes all their fighters. Those fighters are supposed to be designated for ground support and preparing for close air support. He puts them in, and basically they're going to work with the 8th Air Force. And so now Spatz is going to marshal the elements of 3 to 4 different air forces to take on the Luftwaffe. I would say the 12th helps out a little bit, but really we're talking for the most part the 8th, the 9th, and the 15th Air Forces. And the idea is that we're going to put as much pressure on the Luftwaffe. We're going to attack targets that's going to draw them into the air. You know, they skipped Big Week, which is a week of air battles, which was very bloody. The reason why they skipped it is because the 100th didn't do too bad during that week. A lot of other units got it worse. But when we get to the Battle of Berlin and kind of what's going on is after Big Week and after the Americans have really started to burn the Luftwaffe, start killing a lot of pilots, start to really kind of attrit and degrade the Luftwaffe, basically the Americans are asked by the British to join in the battle for Berlin, the battle over Berlin. And in fact, I got the quote right here. Arthur Harris goes to the Americans and says that we can win the war if we destroy all these targets over Berlin. It's punishment bombing. You know, they talk about specific targets, but the idea is we keep bombing the German capital until basically the entire thing collapses and that the whole German war machine will collapse if the capital is destroyed. And Harris has this famous quote. He says, we can wreck Berlin from end to end if the Americans come with us. It will cost us between 400 and 500 planes. It will cost Germany the war. That's his pitch to the Americans. And the Americans decide they'll take a shot at it in March. And so basically what we see now is this is a part of the new strategy by the Americans is they're going to keep going after the Luftwaffe. They're going to keep attacking it. And Berlin's a target where they will definitely come up for. At this time also, again, it's poorly explained in the episode, which is why I'm kind of going into some detail about this, is the new 8th Air Force fighter tactic strategy is different than what it was in 43. In 43, it is the fighters stick to the bombers. And they defend the bombers. And when the German fighters peel away, they stick to the bombers. Doolittle says, our job should be to shoot down German fighters as part of Spatz's plan to put as much pressure on the German fighter force. So as soon as German fighters engage the bomber stream, those P-51s are to drop tanks and pursue those German fighters till the end. You know, also they're taking some of the fighter force and they're having them bounce around the bomber formation called the bouncing fighter group. They're to hunt for the German fighters as they're setting up before the attack. So these are much more aggressive tactics where the fighters are actually leaving the bombers, with the thought being if our fighters don't get them and they get through to the bombers will get them as well. And so it's basically an attritional strategy now. The idea is that we're going to just bleed them wherever we can. And so this leads us into the Battle over Berlin and the American participation. There's two missions. The March 4th one I'm going to make sure I get the right one. The March 4th one isn't too bad, but basically the March 6th one, I believe, is the Black Monday one. And in that one, the 8th Air Force lost 69 B-17s, the worst it did in the war. They also lost 11 escorts. But what's different this time than maybe Schweinfurt or Munster and these other raids is the number of fighters they actually shoot down. They do shoot down 64 fighters, which is a huge blow. And again, they're losing experienced pilots. They're losing more and more experienced veteran pilots. And so one thing we're seeing after Big Week in February going into Berlin is the attrition rate for the Luftwaffe goes up as they lose more and more experienced pilots. And so the Americans, it does, let me see if I got the attrition number, but it is a survivable attrition rate now. It is manageable. It's a huge loss. But because they have so many more planes, pilots, and now they have fighters engaging the Germans as well, the Luftwaffe can't keep up with those attrition numbers. And so, yeah, it's very bloody. Yes, they do use the same navigational course. They use the same route. From what I understand, that's largely because that keeps them out of the flak. That route was the best route because it avoided flak concentration. And in fact, in one of the missions, I just want to make sure I got the numbers right. Sorry about this. But they also went again after Black Monday. They went on 9 March. And in fact, the Luftwaffe didn't really put up any resistance because they needed to rest their guys, which shows what the American generals are doing is the correct strategy. The German fighter pilots are starting to have to stand down missions to either rest pilots or to bring them back online because they're getting so bled. And what the show's not doing a good job of portraying is that, you know, I think, what's it, Catch-22 or what's the movie that y'all keep bringing up? They're taking this catch-22 approach to looking at the generals, which is really bad because that's not how they view it. Doolittle mentioned he hated doing this. He knew he had to do it. He knew he got complaints from group commanders and even airmen. He said, I don't want to do this, but this is what wins the war. This is what beats them, and we have to do it. And Spots didn't want to do it, but he knew it was what was necessary to win. And winning comes first to these guys, winning the war and the air war. Because if you don't win the air war, you don't want those guys landing. You don't want to do a parachute drop where you have German night fighters attacking the 101st Airborne Division over Normandy. You know, and we saw that the German fighters can strafe parachutes. You know, that was mentioned in this episode. So again, one of my big criticisms is they treat these generals like they just don't care about them. They do. Doolittle mentions it in his memoirs. He hates it. He doesn't want to make this decision, but he knows it's the winning decision. And Spots doesn't want to make it. No general and nobody in the planning wanted to do this, but they knew it was what was necessary to win. And so that's one of my beefs, I guess, with the episode and kind of with the series, is that they treat these generals like they just don't care. They do. And again, this is working. It's very bloody. Now, the Battle of Berlin, the idea to break Germany by destroying the capital, didn't work. But one of the benefits is that you do see higher Luftwaffe casualties, and those casualties go up. And in fact, March is not actually the bloodiest month in 1944 for the 8th Air Force. It's actually April. And so, again, we are seeing the Luftwaffe getting attrited, this new strategy put into place, and it's working. But it's bloody, too. You know, it's kind of like how we view the Overland campaign with Grant. In fact, that's where Spots gets a lot of similarities drawn. A lot of people compare his strategy to what Grant was doing to Lee in the Overland campaign. So sorry about that. I didn't mean to kind of go.
Dude, I think that really goes to something that we mentioned last week that you specifically, Luke, are starting to see. And that is they are relying so heavily on the airmen's perspective, right? The airmen's perspective, which is, I mean, let's be honest, like this is a valid thing. Like it's down to that word, right, that they use in the episode, bait, right? Like, oh, the bombers are bait. They're not really bait. Like it's a strategy. Like this is they're actually trying to do something here, and clearly it's working. But if you are in one of those bombers, you can feel like you are bait, and you could have those feelings about what's happening above you. Maybe you don't know everything that's happening on the strategic level, on the operational level. And that's why I think you're right on, Luke. I mean, of course, I think everything that was great analysis there. And I think that what we see so much here, we talked a little bit about it with like the anti-British bias and some of these other things. But we're really kind of seeing like a sort of a lower level airman's approach to the war and how they're feeling versus sort of what the reality is up there.
I just kind of want to follow that up because it took me a second to turn to the stats that I wrote down. But if you look at the April numbers, just to give you an idea of how the strategy is working, and part of it is a numbers game, you know, and I hate, you know, Sarah and I talked about that in a previous episode, but April's the worst month of the air war, really, for the Americans in terms of total losses. 422 bombers will be shot down for the 8th Air Force in April of 44. That represents 25% of the entire force, you know, an attrition rate of 25%. We were talking about 37 in October for the Americans, you know, of October of 43. So that attrition rate is going down. But for the Luftwaffe, it's going up. It was, I think, around 19% in January of 44. In April of 44, that has risen to 43%, which means your total combat force, losing 43% of your force in a month and replacing that. And also something, if you read Mueller and Caldwell, the book that they wrote on the defense of the Reich, is they're having another problem. They don't, when we get into the oil campaign and the oil shortages, they don't have enough time and enough oil to train these pilots. But also, because of the bombing campaign, it's turned into an attritional air war. They don't have enough time to train fighter pilots in general. And so you get a lot of pilots that don't have a lot of flight time. You're having a lot more pilots die due to accidents for Germany. And so that lack of experience is now really starting to hurt the Germans as they lose that frontline force. They don't have the quality of force and the reserves to replenish. And so what we see is the Luftwaffe never really goes away, but its quality does. Its ability to be effective does. And so this is working, you know. But again, as we've discussed, this kind of is a problem with the show in general. It's really good at telling the story of the airmen and the 100th Bomb Group. But anytime it tries to leave that perspective, it just struggles. And that is, I think, where I get angry sometimes with the episodes. That's where I get frustrated. I think that's where others get frustrated, is when they talk about the British perspective, when they try to tell other stories besides the 100th Bomb Group. They just don't seem able to do it. And I think that's because they've just bet everything. Their research seems to be almost exclusively the 100th Bomb Group. And that's where I think Band of Brothers does a much better job of, and the Pacific as well. And I think that if we're going to really criticize the show, it's they do one thing very, very well, but they struggle in putting it into that context. And that's something that Sarah and I pointed out on the third, after the third episode. And it's something that has been a continuing theme.
I also just wanted to say that because Luke has commented on this about previous episodes where he asks us if we like notice the music at different moments during the series. And I, to be honest, I haven't paid that much attention to it, but I noticed it a lot in this episode, particularly the moment when, so Luke was just talking about, I appreciate everything that you just shared, Luke, with, especially with the stats in front of you. That was really helpful. But when you were just saying that, like, this is like punishment bombing, right? That when the, you know, all these bombs, literally it's just like footage, right? Of the bombs being dropped over Berlin. And so you just see plane and the airstreams like in the air, which honestly to me was a little bit, I liked the visualization of it because it reminded me of photographs I've seen of the era. So I kind of liked that like visual side of it, but the music was very uplifting. So that entire scene, I thought it was an interesting, like, intentional choice that they were making, because it almost made you feel like, if you weren't thinking about it actively, because I don't even know if I would have thought of it if Luke hadn't kept asking us, oh, what'd you think about the music? But I was this time. And so I was like, oh, this is really interesting, because it makes you feel like something good is happening, or something uplifting, or something maybe patriotic. I don't know if you want to go that far, but at the very least, it's not taking into consideration like the bombing of civilians and all the things that we talked about in the last couple episodes of the podcast. And so I thought that was an interesting choice. I just wanted to make a note of in this context of Luke talking about punishment bombing.
Yeah. I want to like pause for a quick second to interject on a thing right now, because Luke just dropped a crap ton of knowledge bombs on us. And yeah, I'm pounding the shit out of that. I've listened to the other podcasts on the show, and nobody's bringing heat like Luke is when Luke does this. Like, Luke just went off on like a 7-minute tangent, and it's like, I'm sorry about that, guys. And the others of us are sitting here going, holy shit. So that was awesome. I want to come back to Crosby in a second. I do want to talk about his relationships overseas. But since we're talking about the Battle of Berlin and so forth, Luke, you kind of alluded to it just a moment ago. We've been waiting to see these P-51s in action, really the entire series in some ways, right? Because early on, we just see these planes get the hell. I mean, as a visual narrative of storytelling, they've done this amazing job of setting up how awful these bombing campaigns were. And then we get to spend more time on the ground with these guys, because I think that you could really become numb to what these campaigns look like. And then I literally wrote, Jesus Christ. When they did the shot, you're like, oh, the Mustangs are here. Sweet. And they're like going in. You're like, oh, sweet. This is going to be great. And then there's this shot, and it felt like the opening of Revenge of the Sith, like that shot over Coruscant, where it was like everything. And I do not like the prequel trilogy. I do not want to be excused of that. Except for Ewan McGregor. But holy cow, that shot of those P-51s going head to head with the Luftwaffe. And you got the sense of like, oh, it is on now. What's our thoughts here on the 51? How does the 51 change the air war?
I want to be careful how I say this, because again, there's a lot of P-51 love out there, but there are other fighters as well. The P-51 is a game changer in its range and its capabilities. It has a British engine in it. I noticed that wasn't mentioned. Continuing with that, you know, if we want to just continue with kind of not giving the British credit for anything in the show. It is an American built plane. It is an American built plane. But what really made it stand out is it had that Merlin engine that the British made. And so it has an extended range. It is the best propeller driven fighter of the war. There's also the P-38, which also does a great job, which doesn't get enough credit. And in fact, P-38 did a really good job in the missions on the Eastern Front as well. One of my favorite things to read about is some of the shuttle missions. And there was an entire shuttle fighter mission where they basically go around strafing Eastern Europe and then fly into Soviet-occupied territory, land, refuel, and keep doing it. And in fact, there's like a, somewhere in Poland, a bunch of German bombers are coming back to their airfield and find P-51s ambushing them. And like, I would love to just know what the German reaction to that, but we don't know because all the German bombers were shot down. You know, but anyways, it's a great aircraft. It is the best propeller-driven aircraft of the war for a single-engine fighter. I wouldn't go as far to call it the best fighter of the war because we will have jets introduced later in the war. It can climb, it can fight at high altitude, and in fact, it's such a good air superiority weapon that there's a trade-off made by the 8th Air Force and the 9th Air Force. The 9th Air Force is going to be a new Air Force designed for close air support, as I've already mentioned. One of the things is that the 9th Air Force was going to be given all the P-51s because that's a newer aircraft. But the generals kind of get together, and the head of the 9th kind of tactical air command, he goes to the head of the 9th Air Force and approaches the 8th Air Force and says, listen, the P-51s that we're getting are better at long-range escort fighters and shooting down German bombers. Shooting down German aircraft and German fighters. It's a great air superiority platform. But those P-47s that you have in the 8th Air Force are great for close air support. They are heavier. They can take a bit more of a pounding from ground fire. We would like those to use for close air support. They're better suited for what our mission is going to be in 1944, which, once Overlord happens, providing close air support for the troops. So how about we do a swap? You give us all your P-47s, the older fighter, which is bigger, slower, but very effective at close air support, and we give you all the P-51s. And they do this. They do this right before they start air operations in 44. They swap out fighters. It shows you kind of how there's this element of teamwork amongst the generals to try to, you know, win this war and have the right weapons to do it. So again, it's a great air superiority platform. It's a great air superiority aircraft, but it's not as good at close air support as the P-47. You know, so again, it's really great in its role. What you find out throughout the war is that if you use the right fighter or the right tool for the right reason, you can get the most out of it. But you can also use the wrong tool and get the wrong results. You know, something else I do want to mention that doesn't get talked about a lot is with the arrival of the P-51 and the long-range escort fighter, the Germans have a new problem, which is one of the things they had developed and they used quite effectively against the Americans was they would take their twin-engine fighters, these huge, I think it's the BF-110, and they would use it to fire rockets out of the range of the American bombers. Basically, the bombers couldn't shoot back as these aircraft would pelt them with rockets from a distance. Well, the P-51 starts shooting those things down, and they start really taking down these BF-110s in heavy numbers, which makes it because they can't dogfight with the P-51. So again, that's something else to consider, you know, that it's taking away an ability of the Germans to attack the bombers with these certain types of fighters that are really good at shooting down the bombers. Sorry to keep going, but one other thing I should point out. This also shows us that the Allies are continuing to upgrade their combat capabilities and their aircraft. The Messerschmitt 109, which is one of the mainline frontline fighters, was developed before World War II. They just keep upgrading it, but they don't have any new aircraft. They do create the Focke-Wulf 190 in the early 1940s, but still they're still not upgrading to the same level that the Americans are doing and the British are doing. So one of the problems that the Germans are running into is they can't keep up, not just in terms of the numbers, but they're also losing the technological innovation race as well. They're behind in terms of numbers. They're behind in quality now, and also quality in pilots. And so again, you're now starting to see American advantages towards a long firepower intensive war take full effect in the air war. Again, I apologize if I go too long, because I can go too long.
No, in fact, I need you to go further, Luke. I need, because one of the things that I'm a P-38 stan. I love the P-38. I think that's an amazing airplane. It's an airplane that was designed and built before World War II. This is something that existed before World War II began. It was, I don't know much about, as much about twin engine, of course, right? So you have a lot less accidents with P-38s and a lot of, other single engine planes. But why don't we double down when the air war begins, when World War II begins, and have more P-38s? P-51's sort of on the way. But, why aren't we flooding the field with P-38s? I mean, we're using these P-47s, which have, I guess, less range. P-38 has 1,300-mile range. I guess that's the last model of it. I'm not sure what it was in the early war. But it's a long-range fighter. It's not like we didn't have – it's like we have this tool, but it feels like – and, again, I'm not as familiar with Europe. They're used all over the Southwest Pacific, of course. Why don't we have more P-38s in the field? So let's keep this. I love talking planes, so I want to keep this going. Go ahead, Luke. Let me hear it.
Well, there's two parts to that answer. And again, some of this we talked about a little bit about in earlier episodes, but the first part has to do with the fighting in the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean theater in 1943 has priority, which means that the P-38s go to the Mediterranean theater. We see them with the 12th Air Force. We see them very active in North Africa and in the Med. And there was a P-38 fighter group that actually went from the 8th to the 12th Air Force. So that's where they don't go with the 8th. The 8th is left with P-47s, and they just keep getting P-47s. The guys in North Africa get P-38s as well. So again, that's the first issue, is that they get prioritized towards the North African campaign and later on the rest of the fighting in the Mediterranean theater of operations. And we still see them used by the 15th Air Force as well. Again, I say the Eastern Front because to me, Ploiești in Romania is on the Eastern Front, and it kind of borders the Mediterranean theater of operations as well. So it's a very unique story. They do start arriving back with the 8th Air Force in October. Again, something I mentioned kind of in the lead up to Black Week episode is that the P-38s do arrive in October. There's a P-38 group that arrives before the P-51s, but they can't bring it online in time for Black Week back in October of 43. It becomes operational at the end of October. So there are P-38s actually in the 8th Air Force carrying out operations as well, but let's just face it, some of this is about what looks better on screen. The P-51 does look a lot better than the P-38. Now, another reason why we don't
disagree. Hard disagree.
The other reason why I think we don't see the P-38s with the 8th Air Force earlier on is, again, you got to remember the belief in the long-range escort bomber. The bomber will always get through. We don't need long-range escort fighters. They're great. They're nice to have, but the bomber's always going to get through. There's this belief that the bomber could defend itself and get through, hence the name Flying Fortress. Obviously, by August of 43, after the Schweinfurt-Regensburg raid, that's when the Americans realize we need a long-range escort fighter. But it takes them several months to fix that problem. And so that's one of the many problems they noticed after the Schweinfurt-Regensburg mission. And it wasn't just that mission. There was the Ploiești raid. There were a number of raids in July and August, which basically highlighted the need for a long-range escort fighter and basically did away with that myth that the bomber will always get through. And so it's kind of a multitude of factors, theater priority, doctrine, beliefs that were incorrect. In terms of why we're seeing it on screen now versus the P-38, I think that's twofold. One, I think I have a suspicion the creators have a preference for the P-51, and there's just a love affair with it that most people have with it. And the second reason is I think they're also trying to set up the story of the Tuskegee Airmen that we're going to see coming up sooner. So again, I think it's kind of one is just kind of a preference thing, but I think also there's a storytelling device, which is get ready because we're about to see the Tuskegee Airmen in their P-51s.
All right. I love plane talk.
Well, I got some more plane talk then for you, for those of you who are listening. So I've got a question about a plane we haven't seen yet. Where's the B-29? Are we waiting? Are we going to see that in this series, or is that only used? We know that obviously from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, obviously, but where are the other bombers? Why are we only seeing B-17s? Was there the B-21? Is that correct as well?
I think the better question is why haven't we seen the B-24s? Right, that's a bomber in the 8th Air Force. B-29 comes online in 1944 and it stays in the Pacific. It does not fly in Europe. But yes, I mean, we have lots of the 9th Air Force has lots of medium bombers, B-26s. The 12th and 15th Air Forces are going to fly lots of B-25s. But the 8th Air Force and, of course, B-24s. But the 8th Air Force has B-24s. In fact, when we talk about 1944, the B-24s saw a lot of losses in 1944. But yeah, I mean, again, just different bomb groups, and back to what we were talking about earlier, and I'll let Luke answer with a better one, but we're following the 100th bomb group, and that's the B-17 group.
I mean, I'm going to sound mean when I say this, but a B-24 doesn't look very good.
Oh man. So much hate for that. B-24s.
Man. I mean, it is a good aircraft in what it was designed to do. It did have longer range, better payload, and all that. But one, have you seen it? It doesn't look good. You know, look at a picture of it. I mean, it gets nicknamed
the flying. I'm looking at it. It's ugly.
It gets nicknamed the flying boxcar. You know,
it had very long.
We have still not had a movie on a B-20. Have we had a B-24 movie yet? No, because it's ugly. That's the reason why.
The Louis Zamperini movie the Unbroken, right?
I didn't even know about that one. I didn't even think about that.
That's about the prisoner.
They got shot down.
They got shot down.
Yeah, I completely forgot about that one. But
the B-17 can take a lot more damage than a B-24 could. That's true. The Davis, the 65-foot Davis wing on a B-24 failed a lot when it came to flak and gunfire, but it did have a better payload. They were used in the Pacific, whereas the B-17s were used a little bit in the Southwest Pacific. But when you're talking about these long 1,000-1,500-mile there and back rates in the Pacific, they're using the B-24s. So again, Pacific is just not getting enough love here. We need to have more Pacific movies.
Well, again,
here at HATM.
Yeah, there's more B-24s built than B-17s built in the war. In fact, I think the B-24 was was built more than any other heavy bomber. Going back to the B-29, while we don't see it, they're testing it. They're having some issues. I think it's the Davis wing that's basically put on a Boeing aircraft, if I recall. Sarah, you can correct me. I think you talked a little bit about this at one point. But they've had some issues with flight testing, and they're still developing it. But by 44, they're starting to iron that out. They're starting to produce, and they're starting to bring groups online. And a lot of B-17 pilots and crews in 1944, after they finished their tour, guys that want to re-up, a lot of them are starting to train on the B-29. So we are seeing a transition. We are seeing B-29 groups come online. But it's going to largely be in the Pacific because of what Colin pointed out. The ranges are greater, and it requires a longer ranged aircraft, and the B-29 could do that.
All right, speaking of doing that, let's talk about Crosby.
That was good.
I've been listening to you guys all day trying to figure out my Crosby segue. It's just I was waiting for one of you to say Berlin was flat on its back. I was like, oh, speaking of which, so last week Luke lied to all of us by telling us that Crosby stayed chaste during the war, that Crosby was not in fact learning about diplomacy. So this complicates things, does it not? Now, I don't know what happens to Crosby after the war. Obviously, he writes a memoir. But for us, I assume he goes back and marries his sweetheart, or he stays, goes back to his wife in the U.S. And yet we've got his laundry out here now saying it was happy times in Europe. What's going on with, did this affair actually happen? Does Crosby talk about this?
No.
Oh. Now, we don't know that.
What we do have is...
If it didn't happen, is Crosby's family pissed?
That's the next question I have. That's the thing I'm wondering about, because if you read his memoirs, in his book, he lays out that he was approached multiple times. And for him, it's a character thing. Like, it's a, like, legit, like, this is not acceptable. Like, he felt bad when he hung out in London with his ex-girlfriend, who, you know, and he apologized for that, you know, to her. But to, at least from what I'm reading, if Crosby actually did have this affair, and I haven't seen any account of it yet, if this actually did happen, he would be violating, like, so many things that he has talked about that are character things, that, like, not like characters in, like, writing plot and all that, like who he is internally. He'd be lying to us in his book and what he says his values are. Cause that's the thing that he talks about, is he talks about how it's a value thing that he holds. Now, do I think I could, maybe I'm missing it in some other account. That's, I've been checking to see if I'm missing it. You know, maybe Sarah found it or one of y'all found it, but I think what they're trying to do is show that men cheat on their wives in war through Crosby. But Crosby himself did not do that. And again, I think
it's... We don't know that. You don't know that, Luke.
We don't know that.
I have a quote I want to read, but Sarah, if you have something to add, I want to hear it.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So this is very, like, okay. So I have a couple thoughts, but one thing is very random. So I think we talked about it before, but I actually interacted with somebody online. I was taking this, it's a very random story, but I was taking a Pilates class, and in the chat, somebody was asking, have you guys been watching Masters of the Air? And I said, yeah, I'm actually a historian. I've been commenting on it. So I gave a shout out to the podcast and was like, you know, we've been doing this. And she said, oh, that's so interesting, because my husband, like where my husband's like family lives, like his parents live next door to some of Crosby's family that have been like interviewed extensively by all the people. Right. And so she said that the family was like really happy with the results of those interviews. And that was all we said. Like, we didn't exchange information. We just were chatting in this box before class started. Anyways, that being said, I was also thinking, because I tried to find things, and like Luke, I also cannot find evidence, but I had a couple of thoughts about this, because it can be representative potentially, but also anytime you interview someone with an oral history interview, someone writes a memoir, people, especially when people have kids at this point, right? You tend to leave certain things out of your life story. So like Colin said, it's very possible that he did, but didn't want others to know. Or it's also very possible that, like Luke said, this is a violation of his character and he, you know, never would have engaged in this. So they're just using him as representative. But a lot of people, if it is representative, a lot of people sort of assumed, like, what, you know, people say about Vegas, right? What happens overseas stays overseas. And it was a time of war. And, you know, they use various like excuses or reasons. And then, you know, some people who do admit to doing things overseas are like, I didn't tell my family about it because, you know, quite frankly, that's like guilt for me to carry around. And I don't need to put that off on them. And so they didn't feel that there was like a need to disclose it. And so I wondered, especially because of that generation and expectations and it being, it's always been taboo for the most part in American society, but, you know, especially that era, I just was thinking that like, it literally could go either way for me. But apparently the family, at least at this point, was happy prior to, I don't know about this episode coming out, if that changed their minds, but they had been happy apparently with how things were going with the show and the ways that the interviews were conducted and things. So Colin, I'm excited for your quote.
Yeah. So this actually, like, okay. So full disclosure, I have not owned this book, the Wing and a Prayer, Crosby's book. And I've been relying a lot on Luke's reading of this, but when they showed him sleeping with Landra, I forget what we call her in the movie, in the show. But when we show him, I was like, oh, this is going to be a point of contention. I knew immediately that this was going to be an issue. I got the book and I was like, I need to see where they're reading this from. Now that I've seen the book, first off, there is no, in my opinion, and now look, There is no proof that there was any sexual relationship. There's no proof that there was not any sexual relationship. Luke, I know you're drawing sort of a moral question around this. Like, he would, based on your reading, he wouldn't do it. But man, does she play a prominent role in his book. There's an entire chapter in that book, and her name was Alexandra Wingate, I think is what it is actual in real life, right? Something like that. He calls her Landra. There's a whole chapter called Landra and I in London, with Landra in London, okay? A whole chapter on that. And at the end of that chapter, he's talking about how he's going around London, and he's part of the 100th Bomb Group. And he's like, he says, in the language of that time, I was hot stuff. In London, this paid out in attention. For the first time in my life, I got advances from unescorted women. When they learned I was a survivor in the notorious Bloody 100th, they thought it was their duty to be especially nice to me. Never before in my life had I been a target for good-looking women. And then the last line says, I had Jean at home and Landra in England.
Oh.
Okay. Now, to me, now this is not to say I had an affair with Landra, but he basically drew them as equals, in my opinion, in this one line. Now, what did that mean? Did he have sort of romantic, not romantic, like let's say partnership and sort of a feminine support in at home and in England? Fine. Jean is his wife. She is, and saying that I had Jean at home and Landra in England. I think that if you're writers of Masters of the Air, I think you can draw a lot from that quote, that it's a bold move to put it on screen and make it that forward. I agree with that 100%. But I mean, to me, that was like, whoa, that line to me really said a lot from, in my opinion.
You go, Luke.
Again, I would say that there are a couple lines in there that I will say have drawn my eye and kind of like made me suspicious as well. Again, the thing I keep coming back to is kind of the disgust he has for men who do cheat on their wives, because he mentions it a couple times as well. He also talks about temptation being very real. So again, he could be talking about, and again, this is where we debate kind of like every little word he might have said, because we don't have any other evidence other than this memoir that I can see. And so this also might rely, why we might have to rely on the family and their opinions and their perceptions, but maybe he didn't tell them. But again, this is where, like, you know, the choice to put this on screen and the choice to do this. I mean, how do I say it? It's one of those ones where it's like, I don't know. You're trying to talk about like men cheating on their wives. I guess you could do it through Crosby, but I don't know if it's like the, again, it's one of those things that you're going to start a disagreement and debate over it. And does that really help tell the story? You could have done that through other people as well. But again, maybe you're trying to do it because this guy says he's very dedicated to his wife. So again, this is a hard call to make as a filmmaker, and whether or not it's going to help you tell the story that you want to tell. So again, I do know that there are some lines that did raise my eyebrows as well, but there's also other lines that made me think, it seems like if he did cross that line, he would have to personally grapple with that for eternity, because that would be something that'd be a violation of his code of conduct. So maybe he did do it, but at the very least, he makes it very clear that would have been something that would have not been okay with who he was as a person. And there are people that plenty of times will violate their own principles as well.
Yeah, I was going to say too that I'm devastated that we can't find more information about her, or at least I haven't been able to, because it's one of these cases where just like even extensive like searching, I have not been able to find, because I wanted to know more details about her service basically, and I haven't been able to find that. And so it's just, I wanted to throw out that I appreciate them, you know, highlight the show, right? Like highlighting this relationship, even if it didn't manifest in the way we're seeing it play out, because at least we're getting her story like captured in some small way where she's literally been forgotten. I can't even find her in books. So it's like, she's been pretty forgotten. It seems
I also Sarah, I also tried to look her up. He does heavily insinuate that she has a very curious schedule. She has, like, he does not understand what she really does. And there are lots of, hints that she's doing stuff that is, like, under the table.
Yeah.
And that's how I think we're going off on this. I don't know. I was wondering the same thing. I was like, oh, maybe there's stuff. Maybe this is a woman that people know was a spy or was someone sent to do this kind of stuff. You know, we got the previews of the next episode. We see that she's actually going out there. Even Crosby in his memoir says that she had lots of information about how Europeans were feeling about different things. He was like, I don't know how she got all that kind of information unless she was out there doing this stuff. So I think that maybe they're using her story because, this is all Crosby and Luke, I really hear where you're coming from, but he is so cryptic in many ways in his book that there's lots of ways you can push different things. And if I was a writer, I would sort of say, well, this is a great little way to talk about someone, you know, British women who are spies and in the British service. I don't know.
You guys are missing out. And this is all about the narrative voice, my friends. You guys are reading Crosby straight off. You've got to imagine Crosby is like a future president of the United States. And what you've got to do is imagine him saying, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Westgate. But, you know, maybe he goes to her and says, hey, I'm a navigator. Let's cross some lines. You know, like she likes to get under the table. She knows all kinds of things about Europe. I'm just saying I learned things. So I brought it back. So when you look at that, maybe things happened. I've been dying here for like 7 minutes to give you guys my bill impression, my booklet impression. I've been working on it. So you're welcome.
Now it's out in the world. Here it is.
Yeah. You know, that's what I said to Miss Westgate, actually. I said, it's out in the world. Here it is. So, you know. all right. We've got some ideas. Let's go back if we can, as we kind of come to a conclusion. There's no going back now. Let's go back to Stalag Luft 3. I'm just kind of skipping over Rosie's entire thing right now. Rosie re-ups. Rosie's a badass. We've already established that. Rosie's the best there is. Rosie is Chuck Norris in a B-17, apparently. So I want to see all kinds of like Robert Rosenthal memes coming out after this series is over, because I feel like it's coming. We see there's the British do escape. And also, some of these guys get caught and killed afterwards. That's we're kind of ending here on a bit of a somber note as well. And this idea that the planes going forward are just going to be bait. Where are we going forward here as we head into our last two episodes of Masters of the Air? What are we seeing going forward? I think we've got some Tuskegee Airmen coming up next episode. What's going to happen with our two main leads, with Buck and Bucky? Where do we go?
Okay, I'll go first. This is, I think, maybe why I got more frustrated with this episode than others. It feels like going forward, we're just going to be checking boxes. I felt like this episode started us on a process for checking boxes in the sense that we're going to cover, basically an affair, men having an affair. We're going to cover now, talking about the Tuskegee Airmen. Now we're going to talk about the Great Escape, but we're not going to talk about it. We're just going to check a box and say, okay, tick, tick, tick. And we're just going to check all these boxes that basically we're going to cover. So it feels like we're not going to go into depth on some of this stuff. And this is where I had a problem with the show. And this is why I probably got angry, is I can kind of see what's about to happen, is that The Great Escape would have been great to cover a little bit more in detail. It would have been great to cover Egan working as the security person for the American South Compound. The Americans were at the South Compound at Stalag Luft 3. Never covered that Egan was running security, and he was helping build their own tunnels. And that was
what does that mean, running security?
Basically, he was helping with the tunnel building, trying to keep the Germans from discovering some of the stuff that they were doing. Each officer had different things. Buck Clevin's is teaching school. He's teaching classes on like math, I think. And so there's all these things about prison life at Stalag Luft 3 that just got left out because we're talking about a radio. You know, oh, by the way, Grant Harwood pointed this out. Did you notice that the radio reports that they got are all British failures. And we end with a British failed escape. So again, I didn't hear that in the broadcast, but I was thinking about, was it Monte Cassino? I was like, oh yeah, they're stuck. But he pointed out it was the British failure at Cassino that they, so again, I was like, oh, great point. But again, it's, we're not, it feels like we're just now doing stuff just to say we got it off the list. We did it. We covered it. You know what? It's okay. You know, and I think all of us who've worked in history can say it's okay to not cover everything. You can't do everything in a book. You can't do everything in an article. You can't cover. So sometimes you have to make choices. And I think, and this is my fear going forward, is that they're going to start covering things just to say that they covered it rather than to actually go into depth on something. And this is what happened with this episode. It started with this episode. I'm pretty sure it's going to happen with the next episode. And I'm pretty sure that's where we're going to end at. So I'm not optimistic going forward. But I do think we're going to see D-Day. We're going to see more heavy losses. We're going to see more of Rosenthal. And I think we're also going to see the march by the South Compound from Stalag Luft III in modern-day Poland all the way down to, I think it's Moosburg, which is near Munich, Germany. So I think we're going to see that march going forward. Which is very famous, infamous. But yeah, I think that's where we're going forward. And again, my frustration is I think we've now moved from doing stuff in depth to just trying to make sure we get everything done before the essay's turned in.
Oh, that's Luke, a good analogy. I was thinking the same thing. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to put you on the spot here because I think you brought up something really important to talk about, and that is the idea that the Luftwaffe, you know, they say, you know, if you're not careful, if these things keep happening, the SS is going to take over the camp. The Gestapo is going to take over the camp. You know, we're the Luftwaffe here. We're the good guys. You want us. You brought up some really good points. I really want you to hit on that before we hop out of here.
I mean, again, this goes back into kind of the portrayal of kind of the Luftwaffe as kind of, you know, clean, the same as the American airmen. They're not, you know, we've seen some stuff where they're, you know, basically making conditions worse. But what the Luftwaffe is thinking, again, something a lot of these German heads of the POW camp, the SS does take over. Basically the person who runs the camp after the Great Escape is an SS general. I can't remember his name, but basically he keeps kind of running things the same way the Luftwaffe did. Not out of like, I want to do it, because I care about these guys and not because I care about what's about to happen to German prisoners. Some of these guys are starting to treat American airmen better as best as they can because they're also thinking about their lives at the end of the war and they know what's coming. And so again, you know, this is a thing that we've also seen kind of dodged by Masters of the Air. Yeah, there's a couple moments where they talk about some of the war crimes that the Luftwaffe committed with the shooting down of parachutes in the episode or the POW getting shot. But this would have been a great episode to talk about the prison conditions, how the Luftwaffe, you know, maybe talking a little about how they're looking after number one. You know, they're not doing this out of like, you know, being nice. Also maybe a chance to show what the prison conditions are for the Soviets. You know, there was so much missed in this episode because they wanted to spend time talking about this radio, you know, and that was really frustrating. They missed a lot of time. And again, this is where I got a little bit frustrated with the Crosby Affairs. They're wasting minutes where they could be talking about stuff that's, you know, that they could talk about other stuff that might be better in telling the air war picture. You know, yeah, you can probably talk about the affair. Maybe you could have used it in another episode, but in my opinion, you know, this would have been a great episode to talk about what camp life is like, because you're going to do the march probably on episode 8 or 9, you know, and so they're going to be leaving Stalag Luft 3. So again, there was just so much time wasted, and that was also frustrating for me. And again, there are things they did very well in this episode, like Black Monday, and then there's things that they just wasted time on. And that was my frustration. And now, because they've wasted so much time on this episode on things that are not as higher priority that you need to talk about when talking about this story, that now, you know what would have been great this episode? Talking about the training of the Tuskegee Airmen.
I thought the same thing. I thought the same thing. Because I was like, they're going to check a box next week with Tuskegee Airmen. They're going to rush us through it. It's just going to be, there's so much you could even, there's so much you could talk about with their story on the home front, their training, thoughts and attitudes about them, transition. Maybe they'll do a good job next episode, but I kind of feel like they'll rush us through it. I also thought that, Luke, what you said was important. So I just wanted to highlight the perceptions of the British and how all the radio broadcasts are failures, and how you said that, you know, this is a failed attempt, like failed escape out of the POW camp, because to me, those things fit with this larger narrative that a lot of Americans have about the Americans as the saviors of World War II, right? And not thinking about how the British have been fighting for years before we start fighting, and that kind of thing. And so I was like, I think it's also important to take note of that, because sort of like the uplifting music with the bombs dropping on civilians and this sort of like triumphant narrative, I'm kind of a little bit worried that it's going to be a little bit triumphant and not really delve into even maybe the racism towards the Tuskegee Airmen, but we'll find out, of course.
I mean, Sarah, if with what you just said there, like if we weren't recording this and I didn't want to blow out the microphone for the recording, I would have yelled, "Thank you." On that, because that was what I was feeling a lot of this time during the episode, is that time's being wasted. You have minutes to tell the story, and they're precious when you put together films and TV series. And this is the first episode where I felt there was wasted minutes.
I'm starting to wonder if the guys who make the trailers got away with one here, where we're going to find out that, you know, it's really just about the one combat mission this guy was involved in when he went down and ended up at the prison camp. We're not going to see anything about actual Red Tails. We're not going to see anything about training. But the guys who build the trailers are like, "Ooh, Red Tails. Okay, we got to make sure to get that in there." And that's hard. I totally agree. We have two episodes left. And they even have this whole spy. We know they have this whole spy spinoff thing too. I honestly don't have a whole lot of hope that's going to get a lot of attention. That sucks.
I think that the thing, you know, one of the interesting things here we've got going on here is the contingency of these guys don't know when the war is going to end. They know it's coming to an end at some point in time. They have no idea when it's going to end, but we do. And we know exactly when this series is going to end, which is in two episodes. And in some ways I feel a sense of anxiety because they really nailed this through the first six episodes. And then you're like, holy crap, we're out of time here. Introducing these new storylines about Westgate's amazing. Like I would absolutely love to, but that's a whole other series about spies in World War II.
Yeah, exactly.
A whole series about spies in World War II.
There should be. No, you're exactly right. It's not an American story, really, that one.
No, so unless that's just, again, with the clip of the trailer, maybe she just gets caught early on. So I don't have a lot of hope for her character. I don't know what happens to her unless you do, Colin, but we'll talk about that next week. So
the only way it makes sense to me to include that plot line is if they're going to talk randomly about the 8th Air Force having a special bomb group that dropped spies into occupied territories. That's the only way it makes sense. They had special planes. They did have heavy bombers, but they were like specially camouflaged to do all that. And they flew night missions, but that's the only way it makes sense to me. But you're right. It should be a whole separate TV series if you're going to do that. But I can't agree with what everybody said even more. And I'm almost wanting to start pounding the desk and like going, "Here, here, yes."
Don't do that. Our producer is on paternity leave.
Yeah, you were pounding the virtual desk in our text message chat. I could see it, and I appreciated that. And I'm not really hopeful about what we see moving forward. But let's just be thankful we got six really good episodes.
I'm having a hard time here because I'm still in the Bill Clinton mode, and I just, there are too many things I want to tee off on. So we're going to call this one call this episode to a close. Colin, Sarah, Luke, you guys are awesome. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. That was the end of episode 7 here at Historic Movies, Masters of the Air. We got two more episodes to go. So this is going out here tonight, Sunday night. It'll be out by Monday-ish. And we've got a new episode of the usual pod coming up this week. Dune Part 2. Won't be contentious at all. And we'll see you guys later. Bye.